processes and forms of action of pre-political politics. And the difference, the fundamental difference, is between a period in which, as it were, there is no specific form in which political action takes place, and the modern period in which we have specific, as it were, social inventions for this purpose. Let me quote an expert on the history of Indonesia, Wertheim, W.F. Wertheim, who, when he describes what happened in Indonesia in sometime in the 20th century, he brings this out. He says, the next stage of the movement of emancipation meant adopting a new principle found in the Western world, the utility of modern organization. The history of the movement of emancipation, this is in this third world colonial country, the history of the movement for emancipation may be largely written in terms of the activities of organizations of all kind, of trade unions, of associations of merchants as distinct from the ancient confraternities, whose object was to break the monopoly of Western traders, of peasant leagues against landlords, of women's organizations seeking to break the traditional domination of men, of youth organizations directed against traditional authority. The point is that these are not new aims, but new ways of achieving aims in a context which itself is historically new. In the period and the societies with which we've been concerned over the past couple of days, this distinction is not clear. Political activity doesn't appear identifiable as such, for instance, as voting or joining in activities definable as political. Moreover, the modes of action are not actions which are specific to it. For instance, if you find forms of organization, they may be based on religion or they may be based on kinship. For instance, you see, the very phrase confraternity, cofradia, you see, is different from the modern organization because it assumes, it's largely like compadrazgo, an organization based on the experience, the one experience of linking people that everybody knows, namely relationships, or on the community, or on the existence of the community. And just because politics is, on the whole, not yet a separate activity, a great deal of pre-political politics operates through the primary mechanism of institutionalized custom. But of course, custom in pre-industrial societies, even to some extent industrial ones, has a triple significance. Firstly, it represents the codification of relations which are accepted and acceptable, defined and legitimized by reference to the past. People say, things have always been done this way here. This is the way things are done because this is the way things were done in the past. That is custom. And this codifies and legitimizes in one way and another. But second, it also reflects the way in which these relations are modified as the situation changes. But even though they are modified, they do not lose the advantage of legitimacy and community which appealing to the past implies. And thirdly, custom expresses and institutionalizes the results of those silent struggles for the equilibrium of force, which are absolutely constant, even of less silent struggles. This is actually still visible in the practice of British trade unions, or was until very recently. Any change in favour of the workers, which was not immediately and formally resisted by employers and declared to be unacceptable by the employers, was almost immediately regarded as, quote, unquote, a custom of the trade, you see? And immediately when, after a year or so, or 2 years, the employer said, hey, somehow or other we find that less work is being produced here than was originally, and they say, oh, well, it's a custom of the trade, you see. This was enormously influential, for instance, in the printing trade. And in fact, if I may say so, it came to be known as an old Spanish custom. What? The jargon word for this practice. Well, I don't know why it was called an old Spanish custom, but But at all events, it was enormously. I mean, this is a great deal of the actual fight on trade union rights, particularly in the 1980s, dealt with the abolition of practices which were often quite recent, but which had almost immediately been institutionalized as, oh well, it's a custom of the trade. Of course, in printing, which is a rather customary activity, this was easy. Now, in pre-industrial societies, custom expresses and institutionalizes a sort of collective consensus. And for that reason, it is particularly useful for the lower orders of society. Peasants manipulate custom more easily than lords, and it is particularly useful for defensive purposes. You know, the lords say, well, we need, or, you know, I need to charge more rent, or I need to get you to work an extra day on this, that, and the other, and the answer is, it has never been customary to do this. You cannot. You know, it's in this way. And this is why so often customs becomes an issue in struggles, in pre-industrial struggles, and why almost as soon as it has been formally defined or changed, it becomes a political matter, you see. And that's the moment when politics in these pre-industrial societies becomes rather more explicit. Because that is the moment when legal and political structures and procedures come into play. I don't want to use a language which is too precise for the historical situation. We might call it a political situation, but of course the people at the time wouldn't call it politics. Now, there are, in our terms, two types of political action of this kind. That which was concerned with the interests of the community as a whole, or a group as a whole, and that which defends the interests or establishes the interests of minorities within that population. The two weren't necessarily separate. Minority activities may play an important part in what happens in the larger society, and on the other hand, the minorities' activities depend in varying degrees on the attitude of the larger society towards them. Now, in a sense, of course, most popular movements in pre-industrial societies represent only part of that society. To that extent, they only represent minorities, since the mobilization of entire classes or social groups or people on what we would call a national scale or on the scale of kingdoms and empires is just what is so difficult to achieve. So it was only local bits, and when you get larger mobilizations, they are, as Eric Wolff rightly says, they are like avalanches. They fall down suddenly and then they disappear, you see. They have no permanent structure. They have temporary force, and then the force disintegrates. Moreover, of course, there is another point which divides the political actions of common people in pre-industrial periods and makes them and diminishes their national force or their force over large areas. And this is that, of course, as far as most communities are concerned, they have two kinds of enemies. They are not only the upper classes and the exploiters, but other communities, strangers, foreigners. In Tipperary, for instance, in Ireland, a great centre of agrarian agitation in the 18th and 19th century, the object of hostility was not only the Anglo-Irish gentry, but also the foreigner from Kerry or from Galway, you see, who came in. And this both divides and weakens the situation. This, of course, provides, particularly today, a considerable scope to divide popular movements even in modern times. We've seen this being this happening within countries, and indeed we've seen it happening in between countries. I mean, within the European community, the working class of one country, or indeed the political ensemble of one country, can be set against another country by such things as the transfer of a factory from France to England, or a transnational corporation which withdraws a factory from Portugal and puts it instead into Belgium. This introduces, as it were, an analogy to this lateral hostility and suspicion of one community to another, which we find in pre-industrial periods. However, when I'm talking about minorities in this context, I'm not simply talking to the fact that communities or those units of mobilization in pre-industrial societies rarely cover the entire population. I'm thinking of specific either structural minorities or generational minorities or in other ways. For instance, at the most modest level, in almost all peasant societies, there are one or two people, men, young men mostly, without family responsibilities, who do not accept the social hierarchy, who are prepared to be more rebellious. I've discussed this kind of minority at greater length in my little book on bandits. Again, on the frontiers between settled, rooted, exploited, and governed society, and virgin land, there are larger groups of such people who evade the structured society where rules and government applies, and who have a certain degree of independence and potential rebelliousness. The slaves who escaped and formed maroon communities on the borders or outside the range of slave plantations in the West Indies, in the Guyanas, for instance. The groups of settlers on virgin soil. On this sort of frontier between the worlds of lord and rulers and the world where there aren't any states or any lords, there are, in fact, men and indeed communities who have chosen freedom, or who have been allowed to bear arms collectively in order to defend the larger community against outside threat. Because the weakness, the structural and administrative weakness of these empires is such that in many cases the only way in which you can indeed defend yourself, this is very much the case of Europe against the Turks, is by setting up free peasant communities with arms, whose business it was to, if need be, take arms against the invaders and the Turks. I mean, from the Cossacks in the east to the military frontier of the Habsburg Empire in the west, the Croats and the Serbs of the Krajina. Krajina means, in fact, frontier. You find all these communities which, over a period of time, have a particular political characteristic, namely, they are armed and they are prepared to take arms. It's not an accident that the great Russian peasant risings of the 18th century began on the Kazakh frontier in the Lower Volga, which in turn forces the state to give more concessions to these free peasants, because in some sense they depend on them, in other senses they are endangered by them. And this dialectic is one which we see very much so, that the weaker and more primitive the state, the more it is forced to both to give concessions and to bind these free communities to itself. And it is very typical that, I mean, the test of the Russian Revolution in 1917 was when the Cossacks refused to fire on the crowd. You see, it wasn't the ordinary, because these people who were supposed to be loyal, whose very existence was supposed to be loyalty to the government, when they get to the stage of refusing, then, you know, something really bad is happening and the regime is undermined. Now, of course, what happens, for instance, we see this today in Yugoslavia, ex-Yugoslavia, and indeed probably in ex-Soviet Union, when the state disappears. What you have is self-confident communities with a strong tradition of armed resistance to anybody. In southwest Bosnia, you know, the Croats, in the Krajina, the Serbs, who were, in fact, the military frontier. When nothing happens, he's saying, we establish ourselves, in this instance, as part of Greater Croatia, as part of Greater Serbia. But the essential thing, if you read the brilliant and historically excellent reporting of Misha Glenny on this thing, who's a writer who writes for the BBC and for other things, you will see the essential thing about these areas is they are areas of free peasants in which everybody is armed. You can describe, even today, going around there and suddenly you drive and suddenly see behind some wall there is some young man with a gun trained on you, you see, shooting guns and having guns. And it's this business about these are the societies, normally the difference between civilized society and frontier societies. In civilized society, there is a monopoly of coercion. At least some people have got more arms than others. Peasants are very much fewer. Whereas at this thing, there is an equal balance. And the fact that of these areas where government cannot be conducted on the basis of coercion because the population has counter. Well, very good example, of course. I mean, mountain areas, but especially in mountain areas, very often there's no state at all. Afghanistan, you know, or the Caucasus. But when there is a state, you have this curious dialectic of between the two. However, what I'm also thinking of is not simply marginal communities, even though marginal communities play quite an important part in this. Remember, essentially, for instance, in Colombia today, or it's in the last 30 years, the Communist Party and all the other left-wing parties have been essentially based on frontier communities, frontier settlers. You see, the guerrilla, with the exception, even the exception of the Central Magdalena, but basically, whenever you see that there's a great guerrilla mobilization, the odds are you will find it is in a newly settled area. You know, such as, for instance, as soon as people start cultivating bananas on a large scale towards the Panama frontier, you know, in Urabá and so on, you will find unions being organized, but also military activity between free settlers and the state. the distribution, for instance, of the FARC, the Fuerzas Armadas de la Revolución Colombiana, which is the official Communist Party one, is entirely one of free settler or on the frontier. It's not an urban movement at all. However, I'm also thinking of those other powerful mutual aid networks of the people who turn out to be the strong men in the common people, you see, of which, of these networks, fraternities, the mafias, and above all the great Chinese secret societies are perhaps a classical example. These are composed of common people, ordinary people, but who having to some extent emancipated themselves from the dependency of others. By and large, the model of their organization is kinship. Actually, the model of almost any organization in those days, kinship, even millennial sects are essentially based on a sort of patriarchal kinship basis. With the messiah or the leader being seen as the father. You may observe recently in the this strange phenomenon in Texas, no, in Waco, where there was a millennial sect. Again, you see that the basic model is that of a patriarchal society with the leader as the father, even literally the father in this case. However, kinship, either real or artificial kinship, is a basis. These are groups of individuals linked to each other by the obligations of fraternity. Are they individuals or are they just men? We know very little about the world of women, and so the question is hard to answer. But I think there are some reasons why there's an enormous number of male confraternities, formal ones, and very few female ones. And I suggest that there are three reasons. Firstly, because of the virtually universal domination of males in these societies. Secondly, because as a result, there is a great deal of what you might say automatic structural homogeneity in the female experience. They don't have to be organized. The degree of solidarity, you may observe in the story of travelers in Africa, of female travelers who can go and because they are women, they can talk to the other women in the locality and get information which the women have, not only about their village, but about other things that are going on, without the need to be organization. The mere fact of being in the same sex helps. And certainly, I mean, I remember when my wife accompanied me to Japan, she found it enormously easier, precisely for that reason, to get on terms with the wives of my colleagues, you see, than I did with them, simply because of this homogeneity of female experience. They know what they're talking about, and they're talking about much the same sort of things. This, I think, diminishes the need for formal organizations over a lot of the period. And because single men move around much more than single women. In most of these societies, women, single women at any rate, well, married women even more, are tied to the household, but single women do not move and do not exist outside of the family circle, except for very rare exceptions of the social marginal, prostitutes, actresses, and things like that. Whereas single men traveling around and living in male communities is entirely common. Now, the real force of this kind of mafia-type fraternity, of course, lies in establishing links between people from different communities, not within the same community, people who travel around. Frederick Wakeman, who's an expert on China, has brought out this link between movement, travel, and such organizations in China very well. they expanded, Chinese secret societies expanded very largely and very easily through the networks of trade. And of course, anyone knows that Freemasonry, in the great advantage of being a Freemason, isn't that you can recognize who the other Freemasons are in your town, but that if you go to some other place, you can recognize who is a brother and who isn't. That is structurally the advantage of that. And even, I think, during the transition to industrialism, one form of fraternity, namely the craft society, as in England, pioneered these national networks. It's very clear in England that the roots of the national organization, of national trade union organization, were through the fraternities of traveling journeymen who needed and organized a network in which brother journeymen would come to a different place, to whatever it is, Gerona from whoever knew, for all you know, Saragossa, and they would know where to find somebody who could give them help. You see? Now, such secret societies or brotherhoods were very rarely centralized hierarchies, though they were often accused of being so. Possibly sometimes they tried to be so. I don't think this was true even in the early days of Freemasonry, but I don't know enough about Freemasonry to say anything. In general, they were networks of relations rather than formal organization. The Sicilian Mafia is very typical in this respect. But of course, because they were networks of men who are strong and influential, and control resources and power, even locally, they can play a significant political role in the politics of the ruling class. There is a very considerable advantage for a ruling class, particularly in democratic times, in getting the support of these people. We know that the Americans re-established what they thought was a non-fascist administration in Sicily by calling on the old mafiosi with whom they had relationships. And we know that the Democristian Party and the political system in Italy in the last 40 years relied very largely on the political support of these local networks. In fact, so much so that you find a symbiosis developing between them, so that in some sense the politics of the ruling class even creates these networks. When I wrote Primitive Rebels, for instance, I wrote a chapter on the Mafia and already had something about the Calabrian Mafia, which was just being discovered. It was there as a local phenomenon. It's become very small. But at that time, I looked into it, there was no Camorra. The Camorra had existed as an enormous force before 1914 in Naples. It had virtually, like the Mafia, been eliminated by fascism. One of the few achievements of fascism was that they actually strengthened the force of the central state. And by the middle 50s, when I was interested in this thing, it had not re-emerged. People said, there is no Camorra, there's obviously rackets. I mean, Naples is a town in which everybody has to live the best way they can by cheating, by stealing, by anything. That everybody knows. But what there was not yet, and there also were no doubt slightly bigger gangsters here and there who tried to control the odd market, what there was not is what has emerged over the past 30 years, an enormously dominant network of criminal entrepreneurs politically linked with the political system because they guarantee the political system its votes. Naples is the only part in which the Socialist Party and the Democristian Party vote did not decline in the last elections, you see. Everywhere else it did. The question is, normally speaking, such fraternities, they may amount to a sort of sub-state, but they rarely compete with the state. They are, if you like, parasitic to it. They are parallel state, but still they are subaltern. And the interesting thing in the present situation is that this degree of subaltern symbiosis appears to have broken down in the case of the Sicilian Mafia. which over the past few years has actually challenged the state, is an entirely new phenomenon. I would say that it is probably a sign of the disintegration of state power, because these local networks, they are entirely realistic politically. They wouldn't want to challenge anything that they see. They know what the power distribution really is, so long as they're left in peace. And it is the direct challenge to in the past 10 years or so, by the assassination of leading police officers, by the assassination of MPs and so on, which is, to my experience, an entirely novel phenomenon, which the first time it existed. Still, it does sometimes also happen that such networks and fraternities adopt or acquire a separate ideology which we would call political, or which becomes, if you like, an ideology of a counter-society or a counter-culture, an independent ideology, and which can also play a wider role. In China, the triads under the Manchu emperors were politically identified with the restoration of the Ming dynasty. No question about that. At one stage, the Sicilian mafia was identified with Sicilian separatism, but this disappeared very rapidly when they got regional autonomy to the extent that they could control the access of funds from Rome to Sicily without any further problems. And of course, at a lower level, the individual, as they say, the man who makes himself respected, the local tough or the bandit, can find himself, of course, turning into an authentic rebel. Once again, China is a very good example. If you read the great Walter Margin novel, the one about the one that Mao Zedong was constantly being inspired by, you find plenty of examples of this in a pre-industrial society. So it can happen that secret societies in search of a sort of above-ground legitimacy can find it as potential revolutionary forces at some time. And they may even find themselves in these ways drawn into the great and very rare explosions of millennial liberation, about which I'll say a word later. But even if they claim to have much wider aims in mind, their present concentration on narrow fraternal matters is, in fact, the means becomes the end. That's what they're really in aid of. They may sometimes say we're interested in overthrowing the Manchu dynasty and restoring the Ming, who are a properly dynasty of the Han people and not of foreign invaders. But in fact, to quote Wakeman again, the means becomes the end, and the fraternity, locked in its secret life and suspicious of the outside world, seems to pay little attention to more fruitful forms of political activity and social organization. In short, even in China, where the role of popular rebellions is very widely appreciated, movements like the Taiping and later on the communists could achieve things which secret societies couldn't, even though secret societies played a very substantial part, I think, in 20th century Chinese history. Can think, what they can do is actually, the role in revolution in the 19th, 20th century was very great, but the Chinese secret society, as something else, either they've turned into professional forms of criminal enterprise, or else they've turned into sort of peculiar counterculture, which has been adopted in a strange sort of way by the Western counterculture. The rise of kung fu movies is a very, very good example. Kung fu and certain types of fight, you know, fighting was highly characteristic of Chinese secret societies. And through movies, these have become not merely part of the general thing, but they've been actually taken up by certain character marginal strata of present Western society. Can we think of millennial movements also as movements of self-selected minorities in the same way? The question, I think, is important because the great revolutionary movements of the pre-industrial era have, all of them, have their millennial aspects. So, indeed, have modern revolutionary movements. But note one thing. It's essential in modern revolutions to distinguish organized revolutionary parties and bodies from those who joined them, from the mobilizations of the masses in actual revolutions, and you've got to do the same in the past. One, I think, of the major reasons for the collapse of communism is that communism remained, I mean communism in the where it became a state, communism never became a mass religion. It began as a vanguard movement, and it remained a vanguard movement. In other words, it was unlike, say, the kind of states which were converted to Christianity, in which everybody was converted to Christianity in one way or another. Not everybody was converted to communism. The communist parties remained, as it were, elite parties. And consequently, the attitude of the people under them was inevitably much more pragmatic and empirical. Did they produce what the guys above said they were, or didn't they? And when they didn't, the links between the two were much less. You see? I think this is an important element, because even in the Mao ideology, you know, the famous metaphor of guerrillas being like the fish swimming in the water, it's the fish which swims, not the water, you see? And this difference is very important, I think, in the long run, had quite substantial effects. Now, you've got to distinguish this from, say, communist movements in capitalist countries, which were quite often mass movements of the whole community, for instance, in mining areas, in peasant areas, and other things. So I think it's this distinction, I think, that we have to bear in mind for the pre-industrial as well as the industrial area, the masses who identify with the movement and the minorities, which are often by definition self-selected minorities until, of course, they get power, who lead them. So, in a way, the movements consist of the permanent dream of liberation of the world turned upside down, which at moments appear realizable, and then they mobilize entire peoples for a short time, by definition almost. But at these moments, you see, people don't choose to be mobilized. They just are mobilized, you see. I mean, if any one of you, well, actually some of you may have had this experience after the death of Franco. People had it in Europe at the moment of liberation, in a sense. It wasn't, except for the people identified with the other side, it was a feeling of almost everybody being involved in a certain sentiment at the time. You know, it's quite different from those who fight, as it were, for the breakthrough. Now, there is, however, one major difference between modern revolutionary groups, which were in bodies of individual volunteers, and traditional millennial sects or millennial groups, which are also in their own way choose to be so. And it's this. For the modern revolutionaries who live in a political universe, there is no escape from the politics of this world. There is only political action. It may lead to triumph or disappointment. Revolutions may be transformed into reformist or bureaucratic regimes, or something else may happen, but the only choice for those who don't want to go on for political action is to retire into private life as individuals, to do something else, to become professors, to write books, to whatever it might be. However, For the millennial sect in the pre-industrial period, even some extent for the equivalent today, there is another collective choice, which is to cut the group off, temporarily or permanently, from the outside world, and to construct world, their own communitarian world, you see. To do what Bernard Shaw once called, when apropos of the utopian socialist communities, of which there were very many in the first half of the 19th century, especially in the United States, to do what Bernard Shaw called constructing socialism by private enterprise. There are plenty of examples of this utopian choice as an alternative to revolution. The Anabaptists in the 16th century, the Shakers, to some extent the Quakers, especially in the USA. But even if such separatist sects, you see, all of these began as active revolutionaries, millennials, and they survived this, but they survived it in a different form, but still in a communitarian form. But even if such separate sects remained revolutionary, they still remained on the margins of mass movements, including the new millennial mass movements. The Narodniks in the 19th century were quite right in supposing that the Russian sectarians were subjectively revolutionary. All these old believers and Baptists and others were quite willing to overthrow the Tsar, and the Narodniks recognized this. But they greatly underestimated the isolation of these sectarian movements from the remainder of the revolutionary mobilization of Russian peasants. By far the greatest success in the 19th century of utopia by private enterprise is for this reason totally unclassifiable in political terms. This is the Mormons. The Mormons actually succeeded in having a mass emigration of people who believed in the millennium, which did not come in the state of New York, and they moved gradually and formed their own millennium in Utah, you know. And there's no question about it, it's exactly the same thing. But there is no way in which you can classify them politically, either right or left. All you know is that in the end, like all these self-created communities, it comes to terms with the existing system. And that's what the Mormons did. In the end, they did it at the cost of some slight modification. They abolished polygamy, even though there's still an underground polygamous tendency within the Mormons, but otherwise they became a support of conservative America, which they actually are at the moment. Now, this is, if you might like to say, the logic of... The Mormons didn't actually begin as actively revolutionary in the way the Anabaptists did, but it's perfectly conceivable to have similar bodies. For instance, plenty of Anabaptist communities migrated to Eastern Europe from Western Europe, and in Eastern Europe they stopped being revolutionary communities. They became successful German farmers with considerable internal communitarian practices, but in fact politically conservative. There is in fact a good reason why in modern political discourse the word sectarian is used as a criticism of a certain approach to politics. But of course, against these volunteer movements, they are the ones which people don't choose because they're part of belonging to a group. And here the question arises, how do such groups as a whole take their decisions? If you like, like being a citizen of a nation today imposes certain obligations, so being a citizen of a village or a city imposed obligations. If you're a shoemaker in Nuremberg, like Hans Sachs, you were obviously a member of the city, you were obviously a member of the guild, there were certain things you did. I mean, it wasn't a matter of, do I choose to do this and that? Now, such organic social groups, however, are not homogeneous. The only object, of course, the only choice people have in them is whether to be more or less active, but not whether to belong. And nevertheless, the entire community is not homogeneous, and so you have to take decisions. And the problem of what today we'd call the problem of democracy is a fairly central one. Probably the most ancient method to do so in communities is the search for consensus or unanimity. That's to say, this is a method which is applied in Bolivian village communities, in Russian village communities, I'm told in Chinese villages. In other words, people go around, standing around in the village square, talking and talking, until the real test of the leader, of the man who's a real leader of the village, he goes around listening to things, and then at a certain stage he says, I think we think this. You see? Now the point is, when this happens, even the people of the different opinions recognize that there is a consensus and say, yes, this has actually been institutionally preserved in the practices of the British Labour movement. When there are votes are taken, and after a vote is taken, a second vote is taken, saying, let us make it unanimous. Well, which is exactly the same mechanism, you see. We have discussed this. Now that we have discussed this, let us take another vote which shows that this is not merely minority versus majority, but a consensus of all of us. Still, majority voting is quite ancient. Under what circumstances it occurs as against consensus voting is, I don't know. It certainly occurs in the German medieval legal codes, the Sachsenspiegel. But the crucial element in taking these decisions, and the thing which distinguishes old from new politics, is time. When you talk to people who have had experience in things like these village communities, Bolivian ones, I once talked to a man with a lot of it, I said, well, you know, how long does it take to get a consensus? And the answer was, it takes as long as it takes, you see. If you don't get a decision now, you come back again in a month or two's time, and so on. And maybe after 3 years. Now, of course, for practical purposes, in many peasant societies, it doesn't actually matter whether you take a decision now, or in 6 months, or in a year, on an issue on, I don't know, whether to build a school, whether to extend the hospital, or something like this. The advantage of the consensus, of course, is exactly that it maintains coherence of the community. Whether it wouldn't be better to speed the thing up by a straightforward vote, minority against majority, they are outraged. They say, this is not democratic. What you are doing is dividing the community. Father against son, brother against brother is the usual phrase, you see. Well, And that this cannot be good, you see. So, on the other hand, there are circumstances. I suspect, once again, in these ad hoc groups like craft guilds, colleges, and so on, where, in fact, which are not built on communitarian and kinship systems, where straightforward voting is very ancient. But I don't know the answer. However, you see, in modern times, decisions may have to be taken fairly fast. And this seems to me to be a novel element. Now, of course, pre-industrial communities had plenty of time. But it does introduce one element that is often forgotten. Pre-industrial or even modern industrial activities, there are very few genuinely spontaneous and immediate outbursts. Even, certainly among peasants, the ones which look most like sudden and spontaneous outbursts have been prepared by discussions, more or less lengthy, formal or informal discussions. It's certainly so in all the land occupations by peasants that I'm familiar with, and I'm fairly certain that it is so even in squatter settlements in towns. Of course, it may happen that, say, if somebody comes from outside, Sendero Luminoso comes to peasant community in the Andes and says, now you've got to make up your mind. Are you with us or against us? You don't have time for this. In that case, it is generally speeded up by the threat from the people who come. However, even in cities where decisions are quicker because people think more quickly in cities and come up against new situations much more quickly, my guess is that even a lot of what seems spontaneous, such as food riots, has been preceded by a good deal of talking over. In this instance, a talking over is very large among the women, who in things like the control of food prices and the control of markets occupy a specific and accepted role. Remember, it was the women who headed the famous demonstration in the French Revolution going out from Paris to Versailles to demand control of, to demand bread. So the role of the women is institutionalized there, and of course the women do usually have arrangements for talking, you know, around the fountain, over the washing, at the baker's, you know, there are occasions. And it's these quite informal talks which I think prepare. I'm pretty damn certain the idea which was common among late 19th century psychologists and sociologists who saw the mob, the crowd, as a sort of wild animal which burst out. This isn't the way it worked in real life. Still isn't the way it works. I mean, I'm not saying that it doesn't actually happen sometimes in specific situations, such as football matches, but in traditional, in pre-industrial politics, it doesn't. Now, let me take another thing, however, and that is that all these discussions, all these debates assume a language of public discourse. And that language is often not the same as ours, even though it may look like it. If you look at the prehistory of modern nationalism, to some extent, it's perfectly clear that people feel themselves to be whatever it is, Kurds as against Turks or something like that. But it doesn't necessarily have the feeling that this implies common action on this in the way in which we're used to. For instance, it is clear that when the Balkan peoples resisted the Turks, which they did, though actually before the 19th century the resistance was quite limited, they resisted not as Greeks or Bulgarians or Serbs. They resisted as Christians. In the case of the Greeks, they resisted as Romans, as citizens of the Roman Empire, whose capital was, of course, Byzantium. Romaiosune rather than Hellenism was the basis. But they insisted. And it's also true that when, for instance, you have in, say, the 15th century and 16th century, resistance movements by Balkan peoples like Serbs and Croats and Slovenes against advancing Turks, which we would today think of as being in national or, if you like, ethnic terms, this isn't so. The ideology they develop for popular mobilization is that of the Crusade. You find this in Hungary, you see. I mean, it's directed, of course, partly against the upper classes who have fallen down on their duty to defend the common people against invasion, but the ideology of anti-Turkish defense at that stage is that of the Christian Crusade, the popular crusade. And you find this very much in popular movements which then turn social. Now, of course, these may at a later stage get an ethnic or a national coloring, but that isn't how they start. Once again, anachronism is a great danger. So, in fact, the limitations of popular politics in the old regime become evident as soon as the field of action begins to be larger than it is designed for. And as today, or at least since the early 19th century, practically all the politically effective action has got to be aimed at controlling the national government or influencing the policies of the central authorities, these things begin to break down. Pre-industrial movements may, by sheer accident, have national effectiveness insofar as they actually operate in the capital city. Emiliano Zapata introduced a very strong agrarian element to the Mexican Revolution by virtue of the fact that Morelos is within easy riding distance of Mexico City. In other words, the guys from Morelos could come in and occupy Mexico City very easily. The movement in Yucatan would not have had any effect at all. Didn't, as a matter of fact, have any effect at all. Similarly, if it so happens, governments knew that you've got to be very careful what you do about the inhabitants of your capital city. The most recent example of this, of course, is China and Tiananmen. There was no revolutionary situation whatsoever in the rest of China, but there was a very dangerous situation in the capital city. And how the government made up its mind what to do and so is another matter. But it's quite clear that what worried them is not the stability of the, whatever it is, 800 million or 1,000 million outside. What worried them is what was happening inside Peking. And for obvious reasons. Now, in some ways, of course, modern politics has similar limitations as pre-industrial politics. We have developed methods of operating within the national territories, but hardly any method for operating transnationally. And this is the essential weakness. We are faced with, for instance, operating transnationally, which is at the moment, in certain respects, clearly the central scene of the political theater. We don't know what to do. The only way we can do it, for instance, is by elections to the European Parliament, which actually occupies a very vague role. But, for instance, if you take trade unions, which developed and at certain stage became extremely effective within the national thing, they're entirely ineffective as operating as units within a transnational corporation. The Ford Motor Company, or General Motors, is worried about unions in Detroit, and insofar as it operates in Spain, it's worried about unions in Valencia, but it is not worried in its general policy by any trade union movement which is effectively able to target, because there isn't such a movement, it can't target the General Motors or the Ford Motor Company, not effectively. Let me finally say a word about what survives from such movements. Now, it's quite clear that they still exist in many parts of the world, not just in areas like the Muslim world, but even in odd corners of the developed world. It's also true that the disarray and to some extent the disintegration of the classical toolbox of politics, the classical institutions and language of politics which was developed between the French Revolution and the mid-20th century, leaves scope for a certain relapses into archaism. For instance, it's quite clear that a good deal of the rebellion of 1968 did not use, in any real sense, the instrumentarium, the toolbox of politics, the organizations and the language. It talked a different language. Actually regarded themselves as a different form. If they were sufficiently sophisticated and read my book, as several of them had in the University of Berkeley, they said, we are like primitive rebels. Well, so I was told, actually, by people who, what? Second, of course, certain forms of pre-political action have disappeared completely, or they're on the way out. If there were ever Robin Hoods, they now no longer have any political functions. Unlike condors, they cannot be preserved in a nature reserve, you see. Village communities have changed. They cannot play the same role as before, if only because, the demographic structure is quite different. Often Pyrenean village communities virtually don't exist. They're reduced to 6 old people. And they can't do what a village community was supposed to do. In other cases, like in the Andes, a village community now consists essentially, the people who run the village communities are emigrants who have established a separate position, economic and political status in the city. In a house in the village and who in well, this is a different community from the one it was once upon a time. Even certain traditional pre-industrial institutions which acquired a modern political function appear to have lost it, even in the Latin countries. Freemasonry, which in the 19th and 20th century had a very significant political role, appears to have a declining role, if it retains any role at all. I don't know, but it's perfectly clear, say, a Freemasonry in post-Franco Spain is considerably less than it was in pre-Franco Spain, and the same is true of all the Latin American countries and in France that I know. Nevertheless, current movements must be seen as mixtures and fusions of old and new, all the more so as new, that's to say the kind of political world and vocabulary and modes of action created in the century and a half since the French Revolution are no longer as operational as they once were. For instance, even and apparently the most archaic are in a real sense modern. The Iranian Revolution not only used modern technology, you know, in order to pass the word of the Ayatollah long through tape recordings. But it was, and this is a real innovation in the Third World, it was essentially an urban revolution, a major urban revolution, which didn't rely significantly on the peasantry and the countryside. And the very procedures for overthrowing the Shah were made possible by the creation of a structured nation state and a national economy. The idea that Iran is in any sense like a Muslim state in the century after the Hijra is an error. Iran is a modern nation state in which an ideology which is based on an apparent archaism becomes something else than it by virtue of the fact that it is now applied in a post French Revolution nation-state, you see. So that is important. However, pre-political movements can exercise an even wider influence, particularly when politics are democratized. That's to say, when a mass electorate voting for competing parties comes into existence, a mass electorate most of whom emerge from a world which is not the world of the modern, at least taking the world as a whole, which is not the world of the modern political universe. So, paradoxically, in the early stages of mass electorates, democracy opens more chances for political archaism than the strictly minority constitutionalism of, say, Whig liberals or the liberalism of 1830, you see. Because the basic voters, one reason is, for instance, it's perfectly clear that in Islamic countries, no modern movement can today or could ever compete with the genuinely deep convictions Islamic convictions of the large masses. This is one reason, for instance, why, except in a very few countries, modern socialism and communism had difficulty in becoming a major mass movement in the Third World. There are only a few special cases. China is one, Vietnam is another. In other cases, it was a factor, but only one factor among others. And again, of course, it's equally clear, I've already mentioned this earlier on, that once in third world countries, the common people actually enter politics. The westernized, évolué, rationalized kinds of politics and political programs are besieged from below. You see this, I mean, Algeria and Turkey are two examples of this, and indeed, this happens that you can even see they're being besieged when the old regime maintains control, as in Iraq. No question about it that Iraq and Syria, the Ba'ath socialists in different versions, are westernizers, rationalists, secularists, you see. Now you can see how, in a situation of defense, Saddam Hussein is increasingly making concessions to what he knows to be the profound conviction from below. He has to talk in Islamic language, is not his language at all. In fact, it's interesting that, for instance, the Syrian constitution is one of the very few constitutions of Islamic countries which makes no reference to Islam or to the Quran. That won't last forever, you see. So, to this extent, we are living simultaneously in the old and in the new. This, I think, is the situation, the point at which I want to conclude. But I want to conclude with another aspect of this survival of the pre-industrial mentalité, or rather pre-industrial way of seeing the world, and that is within capitalism itself. With most of these older ideologies, ways of behaving, they are essentially, if you like, seen from themselves, they are essentially inflexible. They, at a certain stage, they have great difficulty in accepting at least the vocabulary and so on of the modern state. But even, if you like, the most dynamic and historically novel regime or system, like capitalism, to some extent rests on the integration of older ways of thinking and older ways of behaving, which had no intrinsic connection with capitalism. This is very, very important. If you actually look at Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, which was, you know, a deliberate, conscious elaboration of an ideology of a new thing, he based it on certain what he thought of basic characteristics of human nature, which one, the tendency to exchange, he thought was essentially part of human nature, which we know it isn't except in the form of reciprocity of services. And the other was the tendency to labor, to work. Well, capitalism relies enormously on a built-in tendency, or of people to work. To work not only for wages, but simply to keep on working. In the same way, capitalism relied, much the same way as these old confraternities did, on kinship. It relied enormously on the values of kinship, including the operational values of kinship. The structure of the capitalist enterprise, the bourgeois enterprise, was a family enterprise. When it had to be when they had to have bigger structures, which were completely new, for which the family enterprise, which in the last analysis is something like the farm or the craft enterprise, when that provided no more market, capitalism had to rely on different models, which were again old models, the military model and the state model. You see, you will find that, for instance, if you had to construct railroads, railway systems, for which there was no precedent whatever for doing this within private enterprise, what you had to rely on is, well, in England, the people who were hired to do this were largely military officers who were used to constructing large public works in India. Again, the bureaucratic structure of the state was, in some ways, the model for the structure of the corporation, until the corporation began to develop its own autonomous way of organizing. Now, the point is this. For a very long time, in spite of Marx's predictions in 1848 that capitalism would destroy all these old networks, capitalism could utilize and adapt these old networks for their own purposes. But what we have been living through over the past 30, 40 years is a period when a great deal of these old networks did, in fact, were destroyed by the sheer advance of capitalism. And the problem which this poses for the functioning of the capitalist economy and of the fact capitalist state and the capitalist way of organizing society are very serious. And I think at this stage, even they, states and enterprises and economies, face the same problem that primitive pre-industrial societies faced when faced by a new development, a new phase of social development, the post-industrial revolution, and the one which, of course, the movements of this new phase are facing today, faced with a transnational scale of activities and others. And it is at this stage when we are all finding ourselves facing new problems without exactly knowing how they are to be solved, because the old ways of solving them are no longer adequate. It's at this stage that I shall conclude this particular point. And then my last talk, I shall continue to talk about the specific problems which have created this, which are indeed the problems of the specific development of the 20th century. Y ahora vamos que comentar, preguntar, discutir.